sweaters. Siskel and Ebert debated the finer points of mass market, art house films, and even 3D.
The 3D this year did nothing to add to the experience of enjoying these movies.
You're right.
All that you ended up with is eye strain and this.
At the movies never really recovered after the death of Gene Siskel in 1999. He was only 53. The show seemed increasingly outdated, especially given the availability of film reviews online. Still, Ebert says he's planning to produce a new movie review show on TV with his wife. At the Movies will end in August. Netta Ulibi, NPR News.
U.S. stocks still gaining ground. At last check, the Dow was up nearly 100 points at 10,932. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from MetLife Foundation, proudly supporting NPR's coverage of aging, on the web at metlife.org.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. Celtic Crossroads is a touring show from Ireland that promises an energetic fusion of Eastern European gypsy, North American bluegrass, world classical and jazz, and the various forms of Celtic music from throughout the world. The show arrives in Charleston Thursday night, and they'll stop by our studio for the Thursday edition of Live and Local to play some tunes. Live and Local airs weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Vintage Vinyl is coming up on Saturday, May 8th. Start packing your used CDs, records, DVDs, tapes, and working stereo equipment now. And beginning March 31st, drop them off at any Busey Bank office in Champaign, Urbana, or Savoy. Call Dean Geiken at 217-333-6503 for more information.
This is Focus 580, our morning talk program. It's hour two of our show. I'm David Inge. Our producers are Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal. This hour's interview comes from the Focus 580 archives, so that means that we'll not be taking calls. On Monday, a copy of Action Comics number one, that was the first book that first introduced Superman to the world, copy of this comic sold for $1 million, and a representative of the auction house that sold the comic said this. He said, if you look at the impact that a piece of fine art has compared with the impact that Superman has had, you would have to say more people know Superman. So how is it and why is it that Superman became an American cultural icon? That's the question that we will talk about this morning in this part of Focus 580 as we try to explore a bit of the life and times of the Man of Steel. And our guest for the program is Tom DeHaven. He's professor in the Department of English at Virginia Commonwealth University. And he is the author of a recently published book. It's titled Our Hero, Superman on Earth. It is published by the Yale University Press as part of their Icons series. And it's out now, and it's fun reading, and you might want to seek it out in the bookstore or the library. Tom DeHaven is also the author of a number of novels, including one that's titled It's Superman. And he's joining us this morning by phone. As we talk, questions are certainly welcome. People want to be involved in the conversation. 333-9455 is the local number. Toll-free 800-222-9455 and email will-talk@illinois.edu. And Professor DeHaven, hello.
Hello, how are you?
I'm fine, thanks, and yourself?
I'm very well, thanks.
Good, we appreciate you giving us some of your time. In the book, you explained that a couple of years back, when a new Superman movie came out, you started to get calls from people who were looking for comments on the significance of Superman, and apparently by virtue of the fact that you had written this novel, you now were considered expert enough, at least, so people were seeking your opinion on the significance of Superman, and they asked you, basically, everybody asked the same kind of questions. But the one that seemed to maybe interest you the most, or at least get you thinking the most, was this question, well, does Superman still matter to us now, having been around for such a long time? How do you even go about answering a question like that?
Well, that was a difficult one for me back in 2006 when Superman Returns was coming out. And at first, you know, I thought, well, sure, of course he matters. And they're making a $200 million movie about him, et cetera. But then I thought about it afterwards, after I'd done all those interviews, and basically it's one of the impetus for having done the book. I was thinking, well, does he still matter in real ways, in the ways that he might have in the 30s and 40s and 50s and 60s? because clearly he's not as popular as Batman. I mean, Superman Returns was nowhere near as popular as the Batman movie, and Spider-Man seems to be much more popular as a superhero in the films. And in the comic books, they never seem to know what to do with them. You know, they'll kill them off and keep them out of the comics for 6 months, and then they'll decide to have him lose his powers for a year, and now they've sent him off. He's not even in the comics anymore. He's off on another planet for the time being, and there's another Superman in Action Comics and the Superman comics for the time being. So I was wondering, you know, does this character still have iconic appeal? Does he still appeal to us as someone who embodies certain values and things that we just automatically say, yeah, that's us, or that's who we want to be?
Well,
so that's why I started doing the book. And you know, ultimately, I do think that the character, in his purest sense, is terrifically important and meaningful. But still, you know, when you have a conversation, people say, "Well, I was always a Batman guy. You know, I was never a Superman guy." But I do think he embodies qualities, and one of them is a kind of selflessness and to do something good for no reward whatsoever. Superman, unlike all the other heroes, particularly in the last several decades, doesn't have a grudge against anybody, isn't seeking revenge, isn't seeking aggrandizement. He simply does it. So he's this kind of super humanitarian, and I think that still does resonate.
And I think that it's interesting that that both those people who might say that Superman was a little old-fashioned and who would say that when they were kids were attracted to other comic superheroes, and I would have to confess I was also a Batman guy. These things that lead you to say he's kind of old-fashioned are also, though, the things that contribute to this continuing iconic status, so that you really can't separate those two things.
No, you can't. And as I said in the book, that every time they try to put a contemporary spin on Superman, it falls flat. Superman has certain qualities that everybody expects him to have, and take those away, and it's just rejected. It's just not Superman. There was a period in the 90s, constantly there was information coming out about a new Superman movie that was going to be done, and it was going to, I think John Peters had the rights to it at the time, and they were going to make Superman, he couldn't fly, and he was going to be this very dark kind of character, and they were going to put him in a black leather suit, and they went through many, many scripts, and Nicolas Cage was going to play Superman in this kind of a new version of him, and it just never, and they spent millions of dollars on scripts and things, and everyone finally said, "Well, this is a waste."
Yeah.
And now, just this week, interestingly enough, the same day that the $1 million sale came, the Action Comics number one was on the web that Christopher Nolan has been hired to do yet another revamp of Superman for a new movie. They're going to throw out all the baggage of the last movie and start all over again. And Christopher Nolan, of course, is the director responsible for Batman Begins and The Dark Knight, so who knows what Superman will be in for in that development. But I suspect that at the end of it, it will be a Superman that's recognizable, because it doesn't make any sense to make a dark Superman.
I was interested to learn that the two guys who came up with the idea for Superman, Joe Shuster and Jerry Siegel, began with a character that was evil. He was not using his powers for good. He was using his powers for evil. And in fact, if you take a look at their original artwork for this character, he actually, the guy he brings to mind is Lex Luthor.
That's right.
So it's very interesting that they started out with that, and that then at some point the character of the character really changed, and he became this person who recognized he had these powers, and that he made the decision that what he was going to do was try to do something positive, and for no other reason than maybe just he could and it was needed and that was the right thing to do.
Yeah, and Siegel and Shuster, that first Superman, which was in a pulp magazine or pulp story that they actually was a prose story that they published themselves, was very much in keeping with the kind of Superman figure of the 1920s and 30s in science fiction, of the, where a lot of writers before them had come up with the idea that if there was such a character who had superpowers and could do everything, he would look at humanity and scoff and basically want to destroy it because it would be so inferior to him. And the genius of Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster was basically to say, well, turn it around. If someone had these abilities, why would they necessarily want to destroy humankind rather than help it? And that's when they created the Superman that we know, mm-hmm. which was actually the first for not only for our first kind of costume superhero, but that notion that someone who had all this abilities would be benevolent, be a philanthropist rather than a terrorist and a dictator.
Yeah, I suppose that's where you can start. If you start piling up these firsts, I suppose those are other sorts of things that would help to explain why it is that we still have Superman.
Yeah, and it was also smack dab in the middle of the Depression. These two kids from Cleveland, lower middle class kids. I mean, Jerry's father had died of a heart attack during a robbery of his store, and Joe Shuster's family were impoverished and living in a flat with no heating. And they were big supporters of FDR and the New Deal and the idea that government would step in and help ordinary people, and Superman was a kind of New Dealer in tights. So it was very much a product of its time.
Mm-hmm. I think among the other things that's really interesting about Superman is that I think that you can look at him as being a kind of a working class guy, and not you know, he's not a millionaire playboy.
That's
like
right.
Our friend Bruce Wayne, not super smart. You know, he does indeed have these particular powers there, although they're things that he was born with. He just happened to be born somewhere else where I guess everybody was like that. And when he ended up on the Earth being raised by these people who are Kansas farmers, he was clearly different. But in many ways, he's... aside from the superpowers, he's kind of an average guy.
Yeah, all the pulp, you know, cloaked heroes, the Shadow and the Spider and all those characters that Jerry Siegel just loved reading about, they all had secret identities, and they were all wealthy playboys. And they did this for sport. They didn't have to worry about working. And another innovation that they came up with this guy was just a working stiff, working for a newspaper. And so based on those kind of reporter movies that they liked from the 1930s, and also based on the kind of working guy of the Private Eyes of Dashiell Hammett and all those pulp characters, that's the personality that they gave to the original Superman. He was a wisecracking guy who enjoyed making fun of criminals and just enjoyed his ability to do what he could do, but he was just an ordinary working stiff who had these abilities.
Our guest in this part of Focus 580 is Tom DeHaven. He is author of the novel It's Superman. He's also written a new book. It's a book-length essay about the cultural significance of Superman. The title of the book is Our Hero Superman on Earth. He is himself a professor in the Department of English at Virginia Commonwealth University. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. I'm just interested in having you talk a little bit about the novel that you wrote and your interest in taking Superman back to and placing him in his time, that is the time in which the character was conceived and why you thought that that would be an interesting project to do?
Well, I've written a number of I did a novel called Derby Dugan's Depression Funnies, which came out in '96, set in the Depression in the 1930s, I'd done a novella previous to that in a book called Sunburn Lake, set in the 1930s, and it's a period that I've taught at various universities at Rutgers as well as at VCU. It's a period that I'm just fascinated by culturally and politically. And in the late 1990s, I got a phone call from, I got a letter at first from the Special Projects editor at DC and Comics that publishes Superman, and they liked the publisher and this editor liked Derby Dugan's Depression Funnies, and they'd been batting it around that there'd been a lot of Superman offshoots from the regular continuity series novels and things over the years about Superman, and they realized that none of them had ever gone back and put Superman in his original context, which is so important to who he was and to why he was so popular at first. And they asked me if I'd be interested in doing a novel about Superman. They were kind of going to loan me their hero. And I had to think about it a little bit because Superman belongs to DC Comics, and I'd published a lot of novels before then, and they're all mine, and I would have the copyright would be in DC Comics' name, and I had to think about it, but I wouldn't have done it with any other character. I realized, you know, I mean, I've always been a comic strip fan and loved Dick Tracy and a lot of comic book characters as well, but I would never have done it for anybody else. But Superman seemed like such an iconic character and such a fun character and so much a part of an era that I knew a lot about seemed to be part and parcel of that era. So with some slight hesitation, I said, yeah, I'd do it. But I was in the middle of another book, and I said, if you can wait, I'll do it in a year or two. And it turned out to be, I guess, about 3 years. They came back. They kept on sending me, in the meantime, all these wonderful $50 reprint books of all the original Superman comics. With a little note saying, you know, anytime you're ready. So when I was free, I worked up a proposal for the story that I had in mind, and they agreed to it. And the important thing for me was that they weren't going to have I could do anything I wanted with the character. I mean, clearly, if I did things that were totally out of line, they would have a problem with it, but I wasn't going to do that. But he was going to be my Superman, and I was trying to base it on Siegel and Shuster's version. In other words, that he was, if you look at the original Superman, he was a fairly short guy. He didn't have any muscles to speak of that you could see. He kind of looked like Jimmy Cagney with blue-black hair. And so I worked up the proposal, and they liked it, so I went ahead and it turned out what I wrote was a 1,000-page novel, which shows you how much I really got into this thing. And eventually I cut it down to 500 manuscript pages so that it was actually publishable. But I did have a great time with it. It took me, about 3 years to do the novel. And I tried to put Superman in real time. So the things that are going on in the background are real. The American experiences that he's going through, the politics, the history, the current events are dead on. And I tried to weave certain things into it. And my favorite part of the whole novel is when I realized that Action Comics number one was on the newsstands in May of 1938. So I was aiming towards ending my novel in May or June of 1938, just when the first comic book would come out. And I was doing my research, and I realized that a play that I love enormously, that seems to have a lot of resonance to what Superman was back in those days, was Our Town, and that it premiered in February of 1938. And I thought, oh, this is perfect, because I have Clark Kent and Superman in New York City. I didn't use Metropolis because I was trying to use the real world. And I said, well, I will end this with Clark Kent going to the premiere of Our Town, which has so many of the themes that I was working with in the novel, and I think so many of the themes that Siegel and Shuster were dealing with. So I ended the novel a few months earlier than Action Comics number one, but I thought it an appropriate place.
Hmm. Let me ask you about something completely different here, and that it is about sort of this relationship between Superman and his alter ego, and it is a really intended to be a serious question about the kind of thing that people joke about. Unlike other superheroes, Superman does not wear a mask, so you can see his face, and in his working life as a reporter, he wears a suit. He doesn't wear the Superman suit. He just wears a business suit, and he wears a pair of glasses. So almost the joke always is, well, how come nobody could figure out that Clark Kent was Superman? All he did was take off his glasses, and somehow he became a different person. And so a serious question about the Superman and the alter ego, and how it is that that was managed and people were willing to buy that. Willing to buy that idea.
Well, it is a most incredible willing suspension of disbelief of all time. I mean, you look at, I wear glasses, I take off my glasses, I look at myself, I look at the same person. How could people not? And I think until Christopher Reeve's movie, it seemed totally absurd, but I've seen this Christopher Reeve movies at least a half a dozen times when I was writing the book. I'm saying, I don't know how it happens, but he does look different when he has those glasses on. He's the only actor I've ever seen who played Superman. George Reeves certainly looked like the same guy with or without the tortoiseshell glasses. But Christopher Reeve, for some reason, he actually pulls it off. He looks like a completely different guy. And the reason I realized with Chris Reeves is that his whole bearing is different, how he holds himself, his posture, everything is so different that he pulls it off. And I thought, that's the first time that was absolutely incredible to me. Otherwise, it just seems one of these kind of you have to buy into the fantasy and don't think too much about it. Otherwise, you're not going to enjoy the story. But Chris Reeves did it for me.
Yeah. Well, that invites some interesting sort of speculations about how Superman might have felt about having to be Clark Kent and having to, in a sense, disappear into himself, be non-super in all ways, and how terrifically frustrating that might well have been, because the Clark Kent that often we see in the comics is a shy, stumbling. He's not a confident man, unlike the Clark Kent that George Reeves gives us in that television series that a lot of people will know. One can imagine that Superman might not always have been real happy about playing Clark Kent.
That's true. Siegel and Shuster first did it, it seemed a really interesting little discovery that they made themselves. At first, when Superman plays Clark Kent, he's kind of doing it as a joke, that he's putting one over on everyone and playing the schlub, and taking kind of great glee in pretending to be an ordinary person, and what an ordinary person is such a schlub. And then, because he's joking about it and chuckling about it very often in the early stories. But what happens is that when the Lois Lane character becomes so important and she's mocking this Clark Kent, what happens as the series develops is that there is this thing that Superman / Clark Kent begins to say, this isn't so much fun. Isn't so much fun to be humiliated and to have to take it for my role. So there is that the downside of being Superman this way is that he has to put up with this humiliation, particularly from Lois Lane. Interesting, when in 1986, when Superman was rebooted and tried to be made more contemporary, as happens every couple of decades or so, the Clark Kent that emerged from that Man of Steel series, and which was the typical Clark Kent for decades afterwards, was someone who was confident and likable and well-liked. And in fact, in the comic books, they had him not only be a crack reporter, but he was a best-selling novelist. So, and something was lost, I think, in the kind of the mythos that everyone kind of plugs into. There's almost a certain kind of understanding that we have that to be part of, to be something so special as this, there has to be a downside, and the downside was that you have to take this humiliation from time to time.
Mm. Our guest, Tom DeHaven, he's professor in the Department of English at Virginia Commonwealth University. He's author of the novel It's Superman, and also a new book that is offering some thoughts about Superman, where that character came from, how it developed, the people that contributed to it, and why it is that Superman is an enduring American cultural icon. The title of the book is Our Hero, Superman on Earth. It's published by the Yale University Press and just recently out. Questions here, welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, and email will-talk@illinois.edu. We have a caller here. Bring him into the conversation on line one in Champaign. Hello.
Morning.
Yes.
I want you to turn your attention to two thoughts. One is 1938, so that's resonance. I was wondering if Superman had any connection whatsoever with the Ubermensch, sort of the Nazi philosophy of a Superman, you know? And the other thought was how much the TV show I grew up with, and I remember the beginning is one of truth, justice, and the American way is one thing he stands for, which I suppose America was his adopted country after Krypton, I suppose. But I was wondering, in that second regard, was there any political influence, do you think, on that TV show, or was it just the spirit of the times? And those are the two thoughts I'd like you to turn your attention to, if you don't mind, and I'll just hang up. Thank you.
All right, thank you.
Well, the first part of the story is that Siegel and Shuster were very much aware of what was going on in Germany during the 1930s. Siegel particularly was a voracious reader. He's mentioned many times in interviews over the course of his life that Superman was in many ways a reaction to what he saw going on in Nazi Germany. In terms of whether Siegel was aware of Nazi propaganda, yes. Whether he was aware of the notion, Nietzsche's notion of the Übermensch, I kind of doubt that, at least at the beginning. Superman was, to his great glee, to both Siegel and Shuster's glee during World War II, banned in Germany, and the character mocked in newspaper articles and radio broadcasts from Nazi Germany, and Superman was called a Jew, and Siegel and Shuster were portrayed as weakling Jews from the United States. And to their great glee that they were it proved to be such a nuisance to the Nazis that they had to respond to it. So to that degree, yes, they were certainly aware of it, and it was part of the constitution of the character. Interestingly, in World War II, by that time, Siegel and Shuster's autonomy on the strip had been taken away from them. And at the beginning, they could do anything they wanted and write very kind of agitprop stories in 38 and 39 and 40. But when Superman became so huge, the kind of political elements and social crit elements of the character were played down, and they had to present their scripts for critting to DC Comics. And during World War II, Superman himself was pretty much taken out of the war. It was thought that Superman could not be shown in action against the Nazis because it would be ridiculous if Superman could end the war in an afternoon. So whereas other superheroes like Batman and the Flash and those characters actually had stories against the Japanese and the Germans. Superman pretty much stayed on the sidelines and sold war bonds in the comics. The business about the truth, justice, and the American way, that was not Siegel and Shuster's tagline at all. It had nothing to do with it. The truth and justice was the phrase that came in, I believe, either in the radio or probably more realistically in the Fleischer animated cartoons of the early 1940s. It was in the 1950s, in the early 50s, when Superman went on television. The American way was added to that slogan, and I think certainly the days, the times, politics had something to do with that phrase being slipped into the television show. But as whether the TV show had a certain political slant, not really. In fact, the first year of the television show, if you ever see it, which is available on DVDs, is a very different creature from the rest of the five seasons. So the first season was basically a crime melodrama, very much based on film noir of the late 1940s, and the stories are pretty grim and very fast and shot like Hollywood film noirs, with pretty dastardly villains and old ladies being pushed downstairs in wheelchairs and braces being ripped off the legs of a child with polio. It's pretty pretty grim crime stuff. After that, DC Comics and Kellogg's, who sponsored the show, were pretty unhappy that the Superman TV show had been turned into a show basically for adults. So from the second season on, the stories are very, very much like children's TV shows like Roy Rogers and Dale Evans, and without much context at all, without any political context at all.
Okay, thanks for the call. Let's go to another. This is also Champagne, but line number two. Hello.
Hi. I just tuned into this show, so I'm not sure if you've already spoken about this, but I was wondering if you might be able to give your thoughts on how Superman appears in the Dark Knight series, and also how he was rewritten for the Red Sun series. If you could just give me some of your thoughts on those two takes on Superman. Thanks.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, thing about Superman, as I said in the book, trying to figure out how many people have written Superman is kind of an impossible task. I'm figuring there must be a few thousand people who have written Superman stories over the years. And some people, most people, just kind of go along with the conventional portrayal of Superman, but every once in a while a writer will have the power, because of his cachet or whatever, or because DC is deciding to take a risk to kind of do a new take on Superman. The one you mentioned in the Dark Knight series, Frank Miller's celebrated Batman reimagining from the mid 1980s. Superman is this preposterous kind of right-wing adjunct of a kind of ultra-right-wing government at the time. Basically, it was a kind of cartoon version of the Reagan administration. And Superman comes out as someone who is a dupe and someone who is simply manipulated by the government to do whatever they want. And Batman is the old vigilante, the idealistic but cynical now. Standalone, rugged American. The portrayal is a lampoon, and I particularly hated it. But it seemed to kind of fit into how Superman was being portrayed, or at least thought of, in the 1980s, in light of the degeneration of the Christopher Reeves movies, where it just got sillier and sillier, and Superman became a kind of a cartoonish figure. But that portrayal of Superman is not out of line with how a lot of writers had thought of him or dealt with him. Even in the Watchmen series, the character who is the kind of Superman character, the Dr. Manhattan character, is used by the government, the presumption being that anyone who did have these kind of powers would simply be co-opted. It's a notion that I kind of resist, because in terms of the Superman character, I don't think a Superman character would be that reactionary a figure, although he has been portrayed that way in some comic books. The other one you mentioned is I'm not that familiar with. I mean, I read it years ago. It's the Superman, I believe it's the one where he lands in Russia rather than in the United States, or lands in the USSR instead of the United States, and is raised in a communist world and becomes a kind of communist superhero. I believe that's the one you're talking about. But that idea of let's make Superman do this, let's make Superman do this, let's take away his powers for a year, let's make him crazy, let's split him in half, there's a good Superman, there's a bad Superman, goes back to the whole idea of this guy's been around for going on 80 years. And the problem for writers and publishers of Superman comics is, what do we do? What can we do that's new with this character? He's you know, tens of thousands of stories. And sometimes, well, let's do something really extreme to get some attention put on him and make him seem fresh and new again. My feeling, the argument I make in the book, is that that's kind of the wrong way to approach this character. The way to approach this character is keep the basic elements of who he is and who people perceive him to be, and then put him in good stories.
We have about 15 minutes left in this hour of Focus. Let me introduce again the guest, Tom DeHaven. He's professor in the Department of English at Virginia Commonwealth University, has written a number of novels, among them one, it's titled It's Superman, and his new book is about the significance of Superman in American culture. It's titled Our Hero, Superman on Earth. It's published by the Yale University Press, part of their Icons of America series. It's out now if you want to look at it. And questions here, welcome to 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Also email will-talk@illinois.edu. I think, as you've said, over the years, many different people, different artists have contributed to the look of Superman, and different writers have contributed, you know, taken the character and gone in different directions and written different kinds of stories. So a lot of things have changed, but then there are also certain continuities, and I guess one of the continuities is the triangle of Superman, Clark Kent, and Lois Lane. Of course, people have done, you know, different things with that too, and it may be depending on what kind of audience they were going after. Talk about that. The strange three-way thing going between these three characters.
Well, Lois is the only other character in the whole Superman universe who's been there since the beginning. She appeared in like the 47th panel of the first Action Comics, and she's the only one. I mean, Perry White and Jimmy Olsen and all the other characters over the years came in gradually. But Lois has been there from the beginning, and she's been actually part of the series from the start. She has changed over the years. At first, she was a sob sister. She was a kind of a Lonely Hearts columnist, and then she quickly became a reporter, and then she became this reckless reporter, and then she became this reporter who was obsessed with finding out who Superman was, and then in the 50s, she became this reporter who was obsessed with marrying Superman. So she changed over the years, but the relationship is this strange triangle. At first, it was the comedy of the series, and the kind of the pathos for Superman was that he wanted to be a normal character in his daily life, and for whatever reasons, decided he had to play this milksop. Was attracted to Lois Lane, who, of course, was in contempt of such a character because she was bold and reckless, and he was anything but. And of course, she fell for Superman, who was everything she admired. And so you had this weird triangle where, at least in the Jerry Siegel Superman, the Superman character when he was in his action costume really had nothing to do with Lois. He would just kind of save her life constantly and but rebuff her every advance. He didn't want her to fall in love with him. He wanted her to fall in love with his Clark Kent persona, which is a very weird psychosexual dynamic. As years went on, she became much more of a kind of pea brain character, particularly in the 50s and 60s, and very much in keeping with how women were portrayed in sitcoms and television shows of the era. And she was just obsessed with marrying Superman, tricking him into marrying her, etc. And Superman basically was trying to wiggle out of it, or trying to thwart her efforts to prove that Superman was in fact Clark Kent. And that went on for decades and decades, and it became, part of the comedy of American culture. Everybody knew that's what Lois Lane did, and that's the only thing she did. And then in the 80s, when our society had changed so much, when the Superman was reimagined in 1986, Lois actually was positioned early on in the series, and it was very artfully done, that she would admire Superman, become friends with Superman, but gradually fall in love with Clark Kent, her colleague, which was kind of the setup of the Lois and Clark TV series. And it was strung along for many, many years, and to the point where Clark and Lois became engaged. And at that point, he revealed that he was Superman to her. So he had finally, after 50-odd years, revealed that he was Superman, and they became engaged. And after a prolonged engagement, including a couple of years where he was dead, so not eligible to get married, they actually did get married. And as I said in the essay, most people who are not fans of the monthly comic books are still not aware of this, that they've been married since the 90s. So that whole relationship has turned into a very modern partnership of two people, rather than this kind of game playing that had gone on from the late 1930s all the way up into the 80s.
Yeah. Any super babies in the offing there?
Not so far. Adoption, but not a child they have themselves. And now, of course, Lois is on Earth in the comic books, and all Superman has gone off to live on another planet because the Bottle City of Kandor has been put back to its normal size on another planet. So I don't know how long they're going to keep that going on.
All right. Bolingbroke, we have another caller here on our toll-free line, line 4. Hello.
Yeah, so I read most of my Superman stuff in the late 50s, early 60s, and I was wondering, what was the deal with the Bizarro World thing? I always kind of enjoyed those because it was kind of interesting to watch something being tried to be made the total opposite and how impossible that was to make everything consistently the opposite. But what was the deal with that from your take?
Well, that was actually the brainchild of this very eccentric and wonderful writer named Alvin Schwartz, who was a Superman writer from the mid-1940s all the way through the 50s, and he created this imperfect Superman idea, this for the Superman comic strip that he was writing at the time. And then, I guess around 1958 or something like that, another writer named Otto Binder, who was a science fiction novelist who was writing for DC Comics at the time, began writing some scripts about Bizarro for the Superboy comic books, which is where he came into the series. And that period of time, the late 1950s, if you look at a lot of the Superman stories, you can see that there are elements borrowed from at the time in most major cities, particularly in New York City, where all these guys worked. The local stations were showing horror movies from the 1930s and 40s regularly on Channel 9 and Channel 11. And so the Frankenstein movies were being shown for a new generation of boomers who were the Superman fans who were seeing these old movies, horror movies, transformation movies, on television. So the writers were kind of borrowing and picking things. So Alvin Schwartz and Binder were basically kind of doing their version of Frankenstein with Bizarro, and then Titano the Super Ape came along because the King Kong movie was being shown 500 times a week on local television. So that's a lot of those elements really are borrowed deliberately because they know that's what the kids were watching on television at the time. The Bizarro thing became a thing unto itself, though, and has really entered the culture almost separately from Superman. We use that word all the time, you know, Bizarro, Hal Bizarro, and Bizarro Jerry, and all that kind of stuff. The idea of an imperfect figure that does everything backwards, and the joke was got great mileage from DC Comics, and even when Jerry Siegel, who had been out of the banned from DC Comics for years and years and years, came back to write Superman stories in the 1960s. He did a series that was a backup feature, I think, in Adventure Comics called Tales of the Bizarro World. And it was just this one gag after another, that it was just these characters who were imperfect duplicates of Lois and Superman and Perry White and everybody else, just doing everything backwards that you could possibly think of, and wrung every ounce of that from the series. But it has turned into a thing that just kind of has... we all know what Bizarro means. We all can speak Bizarro. And a couple of years ago, when I was finishing up the manuscript for Our Hero, there was Bizarro on the cover of Sports Illustrated. So he has a life separate from Superman. But it is this kind of a childish game, you know, of doing, you can imagine everything backwards. And it's that playfulness that those writers from that era really got into.
All right. Well, I want to thank the caller. We're coming down to the point. We have a couple minutes left. I want to have you talk a little bit about George Reeves, the man who played Superman on the television series, and those of us who, you know, grew up in the 1950s will certainly remember that. And apparently Reeves was hired because they liked his profile and not because, you know, this guy didn't look like he spent much of his time in the gym. And the costume that he wore as Superman showed that he was, you know, he was no Arnold Schwarzenegger. And yet at the same time, he seemed really to bring something to the character. And people were, maybe that goes back to a suspension of disbelief, but people were willing to buy this guy as the Man of Steel. And as I said earlier, one of the things I think about him is interesting is what his take on Clark Kent. But I'd just like to have you talk about what it was that this man who is so often dismissed as being your stereotypical B actor, what he brought to this.
Well, what he brought to it is kind of phenomenal. I mean, I watched the whole series when I was doing this book. I mean, and even in the worst scripts, and during the last couple of years, those scripts were pretty dreadful. There was an incredible sincerity among that cast, not just Reeves, but all of them. Noel Neal and every single one of those characters brought a sincerity to it. It's quite remarkable. I mean, you read about Reeves making fun of the character and despairing that his career was ruined because he was so identified with Superman. But at least on the screen, he did his best. And the thing about DC, they've been lucky in Christopher Reeves and in George Reeves that they had these characters, these actors playing their character with such grace and sincerity. It was a very different portrayal. As you say, Clark Kent was portrayed as a very macho kind of post-war, almost kind of noirish newspaper kind of character. Mm-hmm. And he did it beautifully. But to think about Reeves, you look at these things, and he was a little tubby, and particularly as time went on. He needed more girdles for that waist of his. But you look at him in profile, and he was the Superman from the comic books. And it really is the kind of they saw that profile and said, yeah, that's what he like in the comics, and they were lucky to get that character. How many series from 1952 are still watched and sell well in box sets? It's a pretty amazing series.
Yeah. Just to finish up, we can talk some more about the enduring quality of the character. I think now here, this certainly the character Superman is, if we want to call him a literary character, maybe the best known literary characters around the world. And I'm sure if we went out with that stylized S that's on Superman's chest, we went around the world and showed it to people, they would recognize it. They'd know what that is.
Yeah.
At the same time, there was something really clearly, distinctively American about Superman, and it prompts a question like, do you think that any other country could have produced this character?
Oh, I don't know. Probably not. There's a certain boyishness, naivete, enthusiasm to this character that makes him so much of an American icon in the way of Huckleberry Finn. I mean, Sherlock Holmes is so definitely British, and Tintin is so definitely, you know, Belgian French. You know, there's certain qualities in these characters that, no matter how kind of crazy it is to say that there's a national archetype, in many ways there are national archetypes, and Superman does seem very, very American. Although, I mean, no one's going to spend $300 million for a movie that they think is only going to appeal to Americans. Obviously, Superman has a wider appeal, as you say. You know, he's recognizable anywhere in the world. But there is necessarily, I think, something very American about him. And it's, you know, the heartland upbringing, as I said in the book, is, you know, Smallville and Kansas. That really didn't come in until like the late 1940s. At first, Superman, it shows in the first pages of Superman, him jumping over buildings that are obviously in a city when he's a little boy. So a lot of the trappings, you know, that we think of, like Kansas and wheat fields and Superman coming from the heartland and all that kind of stuff, really wasn't there from the start. What was there from the start was this certain kind of boyish cowboy philanthropy, doing something just because it's fun to do, as well as it's the right thing to do. That's the other part of it that I've seen that the character kind of loses in movies and TV and comics lately, is that Siegel and Shuster portrayed him at the first as someone who really had a great time doing this. Hmm. He did this because he liked to do it. It's not because he had any kind of religious or moral imperative at first to help people, which was there, but it was fun. And that kind of athletic thing where you know, I'm looking at these skaters and skiers in the Olympics, and there's all kinds of reasons why you devote your whole life to this stuff, but basically it's fun.
Yeah.
And that Superman, the original Superman, did it because he wanted to do it.
We're going to have to stop there because we're here at the end of the time. People want to read more. The book is Our Hero, Superman on Earth, published as part of the Icons of America series by Yale University Press, by our guest Tom DeHaven. He's a professor in the Department of English at Virginia Commonwealth University. Thanks very much.
Well, thank you very much.
You've been listening to a program from the Focus 580 Archives. Much of our local production, including interviews from Focus and the Afternoon Magazine, as well as local news features, is available on our website anytime you want to listen. Just go to will.illinois.edu. I'm David Inge. Thanks for listening.
WILL programs are made possible by Bevere Cafe. Bevere Cafe offers specialty coffees, breakfast featuring a choice of cold and hot breakfast items from 8 a.m. to 11 a.m., and to-go sandwiches and salads for lunch. Bevere Cafe is student-operated in Bevere Hall, corner of Gregory and Goodwin, Urbana.
It's 11:59 Central Time. You're listening to WILL 580 AM and 90.99 FM HD2 and HD3 Urbana. I'm Jeff Bossert. A quick look at the markets in Kansas City. May wheat at 478 and three quarters, down 6.5. In Chicago, May corn at 359, down 6. July corn, 371.5, down 4.5. September corn, 385, up 2.25. May soybeans at 956, down 4. July.